It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
You guys are in the, are you in the middle of, we're having a fundraiser here at the station, but you guys are also in the middle of a fundraiser. Is that correct?
We've been doing it for a couple weeks, and we got a couple weeks more to go. Eat the State is a volunteer publication. We come out every couple weeks with news and views and local and international and national and all sorts of stuff in between, and we rely on readers to help make that possible. And so far, frankly, it's been pretty slow. So we really need the listener support and the viewer support and the reader support, particularly, to keep that going.
And how can people contribute to Eat the State?
Well, they can do it any number of ways. We can do it through our website. They have a PayPal set up there for credit card donations at eatthestate.org, www.eatthestate.org. You can send checks or money orders or subscriptions. Subscriptions are $24 for a year. They make great gifts. $45 for 2 years. P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington, 98145. Or you can come to our potluck. We're having a social potluck that's coming up a week from today, Saturday afternoon, from 2 to 5 o'clock at Gasworks Park. I don't know if Maria will be there. I'll be there.
I'll try to be there, yeah.
And we'll have other folks from Eat the State there also, and the volunteers who help put it out every couple of weeks. And hope to meet other volunteers that we don't meet, who don't come to our meetings, and also people who just read the publication and enjoy what we do.
So, and if they want to contribute there, they can, what, bring an envelope or a bag with small bills?
Bring a bag with small bills. That's a good idea. Preferably without the exploding red dye. We don't want that. And
non-consecutive serial numbers.
Exactly. Okay. But, no, it is absolutely free to the public. You don't have to bring donations for the potluck, but we would love to see people there. And if you do want to bring a donation, that's a good way to do it, too.
Well, and they can bring food since it's a potluck.
Exactly. Bring food at the same time and bring something to drink and enjoy yourselves on what will hopefully be a sunny Saturday afternoon at Gasworks Park.
A little chat and chew with ETS. All right. Well, moving along, the Amnesty International had come out with a report, and gosh, if it didn't elicit a strong reaction from just about everybody in the White House.
the president, the vice president, the secretary of state,
even the
defense,
White
the
House
joint
dog
chiefs
was
of staff. Exactly. It was amazing. it's a funny thing. You know, you call somebody a gulag and they get all defensive and everything. And their response of the international head of Amnesty International was very telling. He says, you know, when we call Iran under Khomeini, or we call Libya this, or we call North Korea this, this is exactly the response that we get. It's very defensive. It's, you know, it's almost exactly the same sorts of words. Amnesty International has handled themselves very well on this. They've fired back quite adroitly, I thought.
Yeah. What I found kind of weird is that there was all this attention, and this is very typical of the U.S. press, all of this attention, and I also, not just the U.S. press, but the Bush administration, paid to one word, gulag, you know, and no attention paid to what I thought was much more controversial comments made by the U.S. head of Amnesty, who said that he thought because George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and other top U.S. officials, and he named a whole bunch of them, including people at the Pentagon and Jeffrey Miller, the head of Guantanamo. He named all these people. He said, because those guys have violated international law, they are now vulnerable to arrest in foreign countries. And he called on nations who had signed the UN Convention Against Torture to hold these people accountable. In other words, he was calling for foreign nations to arrest George Bush when they land on his soil. Now, I would think that
similar to what would happen with Pinochet.
Yeah, yeah. And he actually, I think he even used the comparison to Augusto Pinochet, that when George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld travel abroad, they should be terrified that they would be treated like Pinochet. And I find that that's, and I found that that's something that I kind of expected the Bush administration to react to. However, I think the reason they latched onto the gulag phrase was so that they wouldn't have to address these comments by the head of the U.S. branch of Amnesty, because really I think they probably are terrified that that might happen someday.
Well, no, I disagree. I think they latched onto it because they are essentially cold warriors, and they are essentially ideologically still in the mindset of, you know, we spent 50 years battling communism, and gulag is that emotionally charged word that's associated with the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Although the president himself wasn't doing too much back when they came out with that word. But all right, anything else on that?
Yeah, but he was paying attention to Daddy, and Daddy was, so.
Mm. Yeah, well, and all the guys who work under him were.
Yeah.
All right. Moving along. media attention. There was a lot of media attention this week on Deep Throat coming out.
Yeah, and it was kind of remarkable, the amount of self-congratulatoriness that came apart. And, of course, as Norman Solomon was just saying on Counterspin, that history of how noble journalism was back in the day is more than a little bit distorted. Journalism has always worked to protect people in power, sometimes more than others. But Woodward and Bernstein were much more of an aberration than they were the norm. Even back in the mid-70s. But, you really don't need to go any further than something like the Downing Street memo to see how something like that simply would not be possible today. Here you have an explosive document, a document that basically confirms that the President of the United States and the people working for him engage in a systematic disinformation campaign aimed at Congress, the UN, and the American public to justify an illegal invasion of a sovereign country. This was confirmed 8 months ahead of time by the British head of MI6, which is the equivalent of the CIA. This is what the Downing Street memo says. And you got not a peep in U.S. media out of it. It got very few mentions in the New York Times or Washington Post, got no mentions at all in Evening Network News. And this is something that we saw again with Guantanamo and the Quran desecration story in Newsweek, where Newsweek had the facts right, but they retracted the story anyway because there is such fear of the White House amongst mainstream media in the United States right now. It's almost not rational because certainly there's always been this deference to power. But you look at how the Clinton administration was treated, for example, by mainstream media in the Monica Lewinsky scandals versus how the Bush administration has been treated on Iraq and any number of other topics. And it's very, very different. And, there aren't any really good explanations for why it is so different. It really underscores why we need Eat the State, why we need Mind Over Matters, why we need alternative media, why we need the internet, why we need all sorts of these other truth-telling outlets in the United States right now, because the major media outlets are not doing their job, and they're going to be systematically unable to do their job as long as we have this deference to power and this lack of accountability when it comes to the White House.
All right, moving along. Looks like the SEC has a new sheriff in town.
That's right. Speaking of dissenters, just as Job was saying, it probably isn't likely. I think it's probably not likely anymore for a person within the administration to be able to do what Mark Felt did back during the Nixon administration and still keep their job and not be completely excoriated. I mean, we saw this week, too, how people who are in the Bush White House and people who were in the Nixon White House were given all this airtime and all of this credibility by the press, who quoted them on how horrible Felt was, and do you think he was doing it because he was vindictive or because Nixon had not appointed him head of the FBI?
Maybe he was doing it because he was breaking the law.
All this stuff. It just takes this completely out of the context of what was happening at the time, the fact that you had these people who were breaking the law and doing these terrible things, and some of them who had already been indicted, and he was just, you know, nobody is really talking about how, you know, you see that happening in your workplace and you can just get completely disgusted. And I don't think that that is as likely to happen with the Bush administration. And here's one of the reasons. This past week, George Bush replaced the head of the SEC, a man who was considered in the Bush camp in the beginning, who was considered very qualified for the job, but there were some concerns when he was appointed. His name is William Donaldson. When he was appointed, that he would be very pro-business and not be for strengthening the SEC, which is supposed to be regulating how businesses report their financials and what kind of reporting they give to investors and to the public. Now, William Donaldson was kicked out and replaced by a guy named Chris Cox. And the reason Donaldson was kicked out was because all of these business leaders who were upset with the fact that William Donaldson was actually taking his job seriously and thinking that the SEC ought to have some oversight function, all of these business leaders went to Karl Rove and they complained about William Donaldson. And, you know, as soon as Karl Rove hears that something's wrong and somebody's not toeing the line, he gets rid of them. So William Donaldson is out, and now they've appointed this guy named Chris Cox, who has this long history of being extremely pro-business. And not only is he pro-business, he is extremely anti any kind of regulation. So it's akin to George Bush's nomination of John Bolton to be the U.S. representative to the U.N., Bolton, who doesn't believe the U.N. ought to exist. He's appointed Chris Cox, a guy who believes that the SEC probably shouldn't exist, as the head of the SEC. It's in the same league, and it's not getting any press coverage anywhere, and I find it extremely disturbing.
And what do you want to bet that when this goes to Congress for approval for the nomination, the Congress won't be upset either, because Congress is also in the pocket of big business. So you won't get the kind of stink that you've gotten with John Bolton, even though it is, as Maria says, an analogous situation.
Yeah. And the real risk here is that some of the reforms that have happened under Donaldson, probably reforms that haven't gone far enough and are still in process of being put into place, are probably going to be rolled back under this guy, almost certainly going to be rolled back under this new guy.
Where is John Bolton in terms of getting into the UN?
We're still waiting for the floor vote. That's still waiting for the resolution of the question of documents that the Democrats have requested that the White House has been less than forthcoming about.
All right. Well, jumping to international, the European Union is looking at a new constitution. Is that right?
Well, the European Union has been in the process of trying to write and approve a constitution for many years now. And Jacques Chirac made the gamble that the French people would vote for the European Constitution. In fact, what's required for the European Union Constitution to take effect is for all of the member nations involved to ratify it in one way or another. Now, there's two ways they can ratify it. Either their parliament or Congress or whatever can vote on it, vote to ratify it, or they can hold a public referendum of everyone in the nation to vote for it. And if everyone in the nation votes to approve the Constitution, it's been ratified. Now, Chirac took a gamble. He didn't think he had enough support in French Parliament, and he put it out for a public vote. He thought he had the numbers that would approve it. And in fact, the French public voted a resounding no. And not too many days after that, the Netherlands held a public referendum. They thought they had the votes for the Dutch public to approve it, and the Dutch public voted no in even larger numbers. And now there is a constitutional crisis going on in the European Union. There's talk of not getting any kind of a constitution approved at all. It's been put completely on hold, and now there's been talk of, is this going to affect the euro, the common currency of the European Union? So everybody's kind of running around scratching their heads wondering what's next, what's going to happen now.
Yeah, and this had come after eight nations had already approved the Constitution, but these are the first two that did not approve it. And as I said, this is enough to throw it into crisis.
And France is a really key part of that, because they were one of the founding members, one of the original nations with a lot of influence in the region.
Yeah, as well as one of the largest economies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and now the UK is expected to announce any, you know, the British government is expected to announce any day now that they're going to put their process of ratifying the European Union Constitution on hold until France gets its act together.
Of course, the UK is expected to vote in even greater numbers against the Constitution.
Yeah, because it's not popular at home. Now, why are people voting against the European Constitution? Is it simply because they don't like more government? That's part of the reason. They don't like the added bureaucracy. Another reason they're voting against the European Union, too, is this concern that laws made by the European Union will trump local laws. And it's the same sort of concern that people have about the WTO, that you have a body that's unaccountable to the average person out there making rules about local laws, like, for example, environmental regulations, labor laws, etc., and deciding whether or not those can actually be put into place or not. People want to be able to vote on those issues on the local level, and they want them to stick. They don't want them to be overturned by a higher body. So that really, I think, lies at the heart of why people don't want a European Union with the ability to make laws that affect them.
All right. Well, we'll get back to the WTO, hopefully, before the end of the half hour here. But prior to that, since we're still on international, let's jump over to This Week in Iraq. This Week in Iraq.
I just want to talk a little bit about the toll, the numbers. We haven't talked about the numbers of dead in Iraq for a while. In May, it turns out, was the deadliest month of the war since January, when guerrillas stepped up their attacks just ahead of the January referendum, the January elections. The U.S. death toll in Iraq in May was 80. In April, it was 52, and in March, it was 36. So you see where that trend is going. The monthly average over the previous 12 months of U.S. soldiers killed in Iraq has been 70 per month. So May hit above the average. Now, as far as Iraqi civilian deaths, there were 434 in the month of May. That was up from 299 killed in April. And that's just from guerrilla attacks. That doesn't count civilians killed by U.S. Iraqi government actions. And there were plenty of those, I'm sure.
Many, many of those, particularly with the various operations
that have been going on. Yeah, and that number that I just quoted comes from the Iraqi Ministry of Health. They also say that 775 civilians have been wounded just in attacks by the guerrillas.
Offensive was the word I was looking for.
Yeah. Iraqi security forces, the number killed in May were 85 Iraqi soldiers and 151 police killed in May. That's versus 40 Iraqi soldiers in April and 86 police in April. So you can see the numbers there. Iraqi security forces, the number dead has almost doubled just in 1 month. The number of guerrillas, the number of so-called insurgents killed, were about 208 in May. And that number includes about 125 who were killed in Operation Matador in the city of Qaim in Syria, 14 killed in Haditha in a separate operation called Operation New Market, which has been going on for about a week now, and 69 suicide bombers who killed themselves in attacking U.S. and Iraqi forces and killing civilians.
Did you mean in Syria or near Syria?
Near Syria.
Yeah.
Sorry. Now, if we take some of those numbers, you know, you've got 80 U.S. troops, 85 Iraqi army, and 151 police that were killed last month. That's a total of about 316 guys on one side that were killed on the side of the occupation versus 208 of the Iraqi resistance fighters killed. Now, if you look at how many U.S. troops are in Iraq, 140,000 U.S. troops and somewhere between 25,000 to 40,000 Iraqi security forces, according to the Iraqi Interior Ministry. Well, they say it's a lot, and the U.S. says it's a lot more than that. But that's about 180,000 to 200,000 troops on the occupation forces side versus, what, 15 to 20,000 guerrillas, which is what the U.S. military estimates the number at. Well, 316 dead on the occupation forces side versus 208 dead on the Iraqi guerrillas side, the resistance fighters side. I think it's pretty obvious who's been more effective in this war so far. And either 20,000 Iraqi insurgents are exacting an incredible toll for their numbers, which would make them, what, super fighters? Or else there's a heck of a lot more Iraqi insurgents than the U.S. military is leading us to believe. I'm guessing it's the latter, that the number of people who aid the insurgency by actively taking up arms and fighting is got to be a lot more than 20,000 for them to exact those kind of numbers. Now, you could say that the killings have to do a lot with things like remote bombs and suicide bombings, and that's very true. Let's look at the number of suicide bombings for a minute. There were 69 suicide bombings in April. Excuse me. In May, the number of suicide bombings reached an all-time high of 90 attacks, which is double the number of other types of car bombings, so remote car bombings, etc. During that month, it's also more than the number of suicide car bombings in all of 2004. So there may be some truth to the other argument that these Iraqi guerrillas, these Iraqi resistance fighters, are taking a much higher toll than the U.S. Army because they have much more at stake. And by the way, the U.S. military is admitting now that most of the suicide bombers are Iraqis. They're not foreign fighters anymore. They're not even trying to put that off as an argument anymore. That's strictly civilians in the Bush administration making that argument. The military doesn't recognize it anymore. Now, I just want to talk briefly, too, about the latest U.S.-Iraqi government offensive. Started Sunday. It's called Operation Lightning. 40,000 Iraqi police and soldiers are supposed to have created this big ring around the capital city of Baghdad, and they divided the capital city into 22 sectors and supposedly set up 675 checkpoints throughout the city. Then they were going to sweep from door to door or sweep through various neighborhoods, do these raids where they would arrest all of these Iraqi insurgents and seize their weapons and so forth. But by Thursday, reporters were asking Iraqi officials pretty embarrassing questions like, where are all the checkpoints? Where are all the Iraqi troops? Have any weapons or insurgents been seized yet? As you see, reporters had been touring the city all that week, looking for checkpoints to photograph and looking for soldiers doing their jobs, Iraqi soldiers doing their jobs in order to tape them and put them on the Iraqi news, etc. And they couldn't find anything. And so a defense ministry spokesman finally came out on Thursday and was forced to admit, quote, "I cannot discuss the number of troops. 40,000 may not be out there at once," end quote. I think it's pretty obvious. It's become pretty obvious that...
Maybe more like 6 or 8.
Yeah, I think it's become pretty obvious that the inflated numbers of Iraqi troops are just that. They're numbers that are quoted to keep the U.S. public happy, not numbers of troops that exist in reality. And this so-called Operation Lightning has really turned out to be Operation Fizzle as far as the Iraqi public is concerned. In the meantime, a very, very serious security problem has emerged in Basra. And folks might remember that Basra is Iraq's second largest city. It's in southern Iraq, and it has been run mostly by the British coalition troops. But the new chief of police of Basra, who's been in his job about 5 or 6 months, he told the Guardian newspaper on Monday that he has lost control of 3/4 of his own police force. Instead, 75% of the police that are supposed to be taking care of security in Basra, they work for the two Shiite militias, the Badr Brigades, which is run by the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, and the Mahdi Army, which is run by Muqtada al-Sadr. Both of those groups are not only pursuing criminals when they feel like it, but they are also engaging in extrajudicial activities, like attempting to enforce Sharia law, which is certainly not part of the legal framework in Iraq yet, but it is according to these two militias, and carrying out assassinations of former Ba'athists, who are mostly Sunnis, and that's been inflaming ethnic tensions in the city of Basra. Unfortunately, the chief of police of Basra has been making attempts to try to purge some of the militia members from his force, but he's not getting any help at all from the central government in Baghdad, primarily because the new minister of the interior is a former top member of the Badr Brigades himself. And that's what I'm going to leave you with for this week in Iraq.
All right. Well, jumping back here closer to home, there was a ruling this week dealing with what happened during the WTO here in Seattle.
Yeah, three-panel judges of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the Federal Ninth Circuit, ruled this week on the lawsuit that's been wending its way through the courts for 5-6 years now on the WTO protests in 1999. This has to do with the constitutionality of the no-protest zone that was announced by Paul Schell and Gary Locke in the heat of the martial law and the civil emergency of the anti-WTO protests. And the it was a very interesting ruling. It was sort of a mixed ruling in that it called the no-protest zone constitutional. This had been challenged on the basis of freedom of speech. You had incidents like protesters being herded off of buses, prevented from going downtown, or even being arrested because they had anti-WTO buttons or had literature that they were carrying that opposed the WTO. And the argument was that this should be unconstitutional. Well, the Circuit Court of Appeals said that this was in fact constitutional, that the city had a right to try and maintain order. This going back again to the myth that was propagated in the stories that were covering this, that the police response to the tear gas and the violence of the police response was because of the looting. The police had responded with that. With the tanks and whatnot before the looting, before the broken windows and all that ever started. And this was a myth that was propagated again this week. But the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that this was constitutional. On the other hand, they also ruled that the individuals who had brought the lawsuits against the city asking for damages could go ahead with their lawsuits, that they had the right to have their day in court. So it was a mixed ruling. It said that the no protest zone was constitutional, but the city was still liable for how it implemented the no protest zone, and that they could have implemented it unconstitutionally. So it was kind of a neither side really won exactly what they wanted.
All right. Maria, can you give us a summary in about a minute or thereabouts about a biotech report that came out by Ernst & Young this week?
Yeah, Ernst & Young is one of the major accounting firms in this country, and it came out with an annual report. It looks at biotech every year, and it makes a little guess about how profitable biotech is going to be in the coming years. And in previous years, it had said that it expected the biotech industry to be profitable by the year 2008. But in this year's annual report, it said that actually it didn't expect the biotech industry as a whole to become profitable for at least another 10 years. Now, I can give you the figures for the losses. Let's see here. In 2002, net losses were $9.4 billion for the industry. In 2003, they were $3.2 billion, so you'd think they were going in the right direction, right? But by last year, it was up to $4.3 billion in losses. So it looks like that distant goal of biotech bringing lots of jobs and being profitable and being the driver of the new economy is getting ever further and further in the distance. So we should keep that in mind when we hear local politicians say we have to spend public money to attract lots and lots of biotech firms to our area.
Although they'll be profitable that much sooner if the public's underwriting the whole enterprise.
Profitable.
Somehow I don't think so.
All right. Talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Comes out every couple of weeks. You can find it where people find free periodicals, bookstores, cafes, places like that. You can also find publications and donate to the publication online, www.eatthestate.org. And don't forget to come to our social potluck next Saturday afternoon from 2 to 5 at Gasworks Park.